to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell. How are you?
I'm just glad to be talking about movies with my friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, directors are ingrates. At least that's the vibe you might get coming from certain corners of the public and from film Twitter, as Christopher Nolan, Denis Villeneuve, and Judd Apatow go on the warpath against Warner Brothers and AT&T for unilaterally deciding to release their films on HBO Max and in theaters simultaneously rather than in theaters alone. In an op-ed for Variety, Villeneuve wrote that he learned of the decision in the news, which is just absolutely amazing. Appearing on NPR's All Things Considered, Christopher Nolan warned of the deleterious effects this would have on union members. Quote, "The grips, the electricians who depend on, you know, IA and IA residuals for pension and healthcare. I'm talking about SAG. That's why the residual structure is in place," end quote. Judd Apatow said, quote, "It's the type of disrespect that you hear about in the history of show business," end quote. So are these directors, you know, are they just being kind of whiny? After all, consumers are demanding to be able to watch things at home on TV, having decided that theaters, where literally zero COVID transmissions have been confirmed to have happened literally anywhere in the world, are unsafe. And baby always gets its bottle, right? That's how it works. And the studios, you know, they should get some say here, right? After all, they're the ones who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these and other films. They've given Christopher Nolan, you know, literally something like $600 million over the years to pursue his passion projects. You know, they gave Denis Villeneuve $200 million to make sure that the spice flows. They should have some say in this, right? Alyssa, should directors just shut their dang mouths and let Warner Brothers and AT&T destroy the theatrical model?
No. I think, first of all, the way that Warner's handled this was obviously done primarily in a way that would prevent the news from leaking in the media before they wanted it to come out, but it would have been far better for the news to leak in the media as they were having a series of conversations with the people who make their movies so that they would not be blindsided and, you know, in a position where they felt like they were being treated as completely disposable. Like, yes, the studios have the money, but the directors have the talent, and the directors are the people who the actors want to work with. Like, nobody used, like, Timothée Chalamet is not super excited to go work with AT&T, right? I mean, and I thought one thing that Villeneuve really emphasized in his op-ed for Variety is that this is a business that is built on relationships and trust. It is not a matter of stamping out widgets in a factory. It is almost entirely relationship driven. Yes, there's data and box office analysis and everything else, but making a movie is a matter of getting together dozens or hundreds of people, keeping them from going completely bananas at each other and getting them to produce at the highest level, you know, for over long shoots, over publicity tours. And when you blow up that trust, you make it difficult to do your core business. But I think there are sort of two core disputes here. One is about business model and whether or not a model that is more balanced towards streaming, although perhaps with some theatrical revenue included, continues to produce the kind of movies that the studios think that they make money off of. The second is whether a movie as seen in a theater is a distinct form of art from a random thing that you watch on your television at home. And I think that the directors are as upset as they are, both for reasons of economics. I mean, and I think it's absolutely true that there are going to be people who are really hurt by these decisions, and that there are just a lot of down-the-line consequences that are not part of the general discussion. I had not realized until this happened, for example, that there is a formula in place that uses box office revenue to determine what TV syndication deals for movies look like. So there are just a lot of downstream consequences here. But people like Villeneuve believe that there is something distinct about seeing a movie in a theater with other people. He says in his op-ed, "Our movie's image and sound were meticulously designed to be seen in theaters." And folks like him and Christopher Nolan fundamentally believe that watching something on your television at home and watching it in theaters, which with, you know, an image and sound that have been optimized for that, that they're not substitute goods. And AT&T and Warner Brothers clearly believe that they're close enough. And that's just a really fundamental disagreement. And if Warner Brothers' brand in part was that we actually care about artistry and the cinematic experience, and then they've just gone, nah, we don't care about all of that, that's a really damaging thing for them.
Yeah, Peter, we're going to talk about sound design and the importance thereof in a moment when we get to Sound of Metal, which we're reviewing this week. But I do think that there is, there's a real big issue, not just from the technical audio visual side of things, but the economic side of things. I mean, look, you cannot replace the money that theatrical brings in via streaming. Certainly not yet, possibly not ever. And when you make less money, you have less money to give to the people that Christopher Nolan mentioned, you know, the IATSE members, the SAG members. This is to say nothing of, you know, the money directors make. You know, there are all sorts of unintended economic consequences here. And it's to unilaterally do something like this strikes me as not just a form of artistic warfare in a way, but a form of economic warfare.
Well, there's certainly economic consequences here. Look, there's always a power struggle in Hollywood between art and commerce. It is in many ways, certainly for much of the last 100 years, it is the biggest kind of artistic slash economic enterprise in the world, right? I mean, where the place where sort of the big ambitions of businessmen and the biggest ambitions of artists collide and come together and need to work together. I think Warner Brothers handled this in a way that was bound to generate pushback. They didn't tell people. On the other hand, it's also kind of hard to imagine how they could have told people in a way that wasn't guaranteed to leak long before they wanted this to get out there. And so I think probably, I obviously have no inside information, but my suspicion here is they felt like they wanted to make an announcement. They wanted to get it out before Christmas, try to get HBO Max signups. And they also couldn't figure out a way to do this in a period of time where it wasn't going to come out at some point anyway. So they just had to let people know publicly and then go to their partners and talk afterwards. I think folks like Villeneuve and Christopher Nolan have power. They are going to exert that power in the future. My suspicion is that we are going to see contractual obligations of more traditional theatrical releases. But I also think that everyone, you know, who is complaining about this is missing a couple of things. One is that putting all of these movies on streaming simultaneously really does open up opportunities for people to see these sorts of things, people who might not have been able to see them. It makes it less expensive. It makes it much more accessible. I mean, it's not just the financial cost of going to see the movies, the babysitter, the parking, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's also the time. And a lot of people just don't have the basically 4 hours that it takes to leave the house, go park, go wait for the trailers, stand in line, the whole thing, and see a movie. And this means that more people are going to be able to see those things at least more quickly. The other thing, though, is these are not non-theatrical releases. These movies are all going to be released in theaters. And fans who want to see these movies in theaters are going to have that opportunity. No one who doesn't want to see this movie who wants to see this movie in a theater is going to be prohibited unless their state governor says your movie theater is closed.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that the theatrical model does not work, and you know this. I mean, you understand that the theatrical model as it exists, frankly, for the last, you know, 100 or so years, does not work without that sort of window.
I think it does not. That model cannot going to work.
Hold on. I let you have your say. The problem is the theatrical model does not work because if you give people the option of watching something at home immediately or going to the theater and seeing it, even folks who, you know, appreciate the theatrical experience and even folks who like IMAX and Dolby or whatever, you know, most of them are still just going to end up watching it at home for reasons of convenience. Convenience is a huge factor.
Certainly some.
It's 100. It is. I bet it's close to 80%. I bet if you took 100 people who were going to go see something in the theater and said, well, you know what, you can actually watch this at home for less money right now from the comfort of your couch. 80% of those people would stay at home.
And because I'm a lunatic, I actually went and checked. And to replicate the box office of The Dark Knight Rises, you would need 72,124,178 months of individual HBO Max subscriptions. That's a lot. And that, I mean, that's more than an entire month of the streaming service's revenue based on the number of subscribers they have now. And I think one thing that will be, we're all talking about this as if it's guaranteed to work. And I think a really interesting question over the next year will be, how many subscriptions does this actually drive? And then what happens to the movies on the Warner slate that are released in theaters later in the year? I mean, In the Heights is coming out on June 18th. That could be a time when a lot of people have vaccines, when people are, you know, the kids are out of school for the summer. It's a Lin-Manuel Miranda musical. Maybe it becomes a family movie thing. You know, Dune comes out in October. The Matrix 4 comes out on December 22nd, by which point I think most Americans who want vaccines will probably be able to get them. Movies like King Richard, which is about the Williams sisters' father, and then Judas and the Black Messiah, seem likely to be scheduled as late year Oscar bait. And those are movies that could both be real lures for people who are desperate for a date night, or frankly could be causes of the way that we've seen, you know, with some of Ryan Coogler's movies. And so it will be really interesting to see if Warner's gamble that this is going to drive a lot of permanent subscriptions to HBO Max actually works. Because one of the things that we've seen a lot during the pandemic is that people have added new streaming subscriptions, but they've dropped others. There's been a lot of churn. And so if we see a situation where, you know, people subscribe for a month because they want to watch two Warner's movies, but then drop the service because actually they're not that into Dune. And maybe, you know, Dune was a crazy proposition as a $200 million movie anyway, but I digress. You know, it's not for sure that this is going to work out. And so I think that before we declare, you know, movies murdered, theatrical movie going murdered by Warner Brothers, next year is going to provide a lot of interesting data.
I certainly think it's true that it's not guaranteed to work. This is a one-year experiment. Warner Brothers CEO, Warner Media CEO, Jason Keeler is saying we're doing this for a year, and he is very clearly not commenting on what 2022 will hold. And so they may reverse themselves, and they may find that this is a pandemic plan that is temporary and nothing else. But they also may find that this is something they want to continue. And I just think that, you know, sort of with competition from Netflix, with the advances in home theater design, in any case, even without a pandemic, we were going to inch, not run towards, but inch ever towards more day and date type simultaneous releases, more options for consumers, more choice for people who want to watch this stuff at home, right? When there is demand for that, someone will try to figure out how to provide it. That's what Netflix has done. And Netflix has messed up the industry in a bunch of ways. And people are trying to figure out what to do about that. And a lot of the kind of Disney Plus, you know, HBO Max, Hulu world of things is a response to the fact that Netflix has been so successful at giving people something that they clearly want, which is the option to see a lot of original content from the comfort of their own home and not have to leave and just pay a monthly subscription price for that. So, you know, I think it's going to be an interesting experiment. I absolutely think there are downsides. I love seeing movies in theaters. I suspect that whether this works or not, one result of this sort of experimentation, and it's not just Warner Brothers doing this, to be clear, Disney is also moving in this direction, just not quite as aggressively. All right. They are putting a number of their big budget films on Disney Plus. They're investing very, very heavily just in Disney Plus content, probably at the expense of theatrical at this point. So it's not just Warner Brothers. I think this experiment's going to tell us something interesting. I think it's going to move the ball forward. And I think it was inevitable that at some point you were just going to start to see studios and producers and people who have money on the line here, not just the kind of artistic power, but people who have financial power say, look, there's very clearly a demand to watch this stuff at home. We have the technology to do that. Let's provide it to people.
Until then, though, WB and AT&T have a real headache on their hands PR-wise, because they have a series of directors coming out and saying, hey, you know, this is messed up. You shouldn't have done this to us. Here is, I'm going to suggest a course of action they could take and that we might see them take. Allow me to offer the following as a way of mitigating some of this. What if they were to talk to, a director who has some experience in the world of PR and advocacy, who has championed, let's say, African-American filmmakers, and says, you know, and Warner Brothers goes to this person and says, hey, what if we came up with a nice slate of movies that, you know, maybe are a little bit cheaper? We can get them out there straight to people. And we say, no, look, these old directors, they don't know what they're talking about. We can create more diversity. There's a big opportunity for Warner Brothers to reach out to somebody like Ava DuVernay, is what I'm saying, and to say, hey, what if we sponsored African-American directors who haven't gotten a chance?
Maybe, although I think Netflix has kind of beaten them to that. I mean, they had, you know, she's been in business with them. They gave that mega deal to Kenny Barris that didn't really work. But even so, they got Shonda Rhimes locked up.
Do we have any numbers on the Small Axe films, how they have done?
Not yet.
Many numbers as we have on all the other streaming products.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think it would look pretty cynical if Warner's did that.
Wait.
Which,
wait.
I know.
Cynical?
A big corporation making a cynical diversity play, Alyssa?
I'm saying that I think this cynical diversity play would be less effective than many other cynical diversity plays.
I don't know. I just think
frankly, Sonny, do you think, you know, black filmmakers can just be shunted aside to streaming services and, you know, locked out of the theatrical experience?
No, I mean, I think that would be the obvious rejoinder. I'm trying to spitball ideas for how Warner Brothers could worm their way out of this.
Talk about Alyssa's actual, like, the phrase you used there, shunted aside. I think that's certainly how some people are going to see this. And that's how Nolan and Villeneuve feel about their films, that they've just been sort of unceremoniously dumped into a streaming world that, you know, people are going to be seeing these things on phones, on laptops, on small screens that they don't control, you know, like critics have been all year during the pandemic. That's another story. But the idea that these films are being shunted aside, I think, is in some ways, it's at least not proven to me. And so we have, and just to kind of talk about something that all three of us have a different experience of, is that all three of us have worked at publications that have web-only stuff and stuff that also goes in a print edition. There's like always a divide there between things that go into prints and things that go into web. And like, it is certainly the case, I have heard at other publications, I'll say, that sometimes authors think they're going to go into print and then find out they're going on web and they get a little bit upset, and they would have preferred to go into the print edition because it is seen as more prestigious. But guess what? When you are online, the .com version often ends up being the thing that far, far, far more people end up seeing. And I think that is something that is at least a possibility here. Obviously, we haven't run one of these experiments. We're still early days. But there is a real possibility that films that end up going direct to streaming are going to have much bigger audiences, even if the viewing experience isn't exactly what Christopher Nolan wants.
But I think that these filmmakers believe that the experience of seeing something theatrically is so fundamentally different that they're not substitute goods. I mean, trust me, as someone who works in the Washington Post opinion section that has an incredibly limited amount of print space, you know, people talk about the web print divide all the time, but the experience, I mean, text is text, right? It's not, I mean, you know, the text that we print in the paper and the text that runs only on the website, at least for stuff that's not augmented by multimedia, is fundamentally the same. And
there are a lot of people who really prefer the experience of reading in print. You get better art, you know, some people might argue, right? Or certainly it's different. It is a different experience. And I think,
I'm saying, yeah,
I agree, I think, that text is text, but I think that a lot of people could say image is image. And Christopher Nolan doesn't see that. And magazine feature writers who are used to being, you know, who grew up in the print world, there is a school of them that sees that sees the web as like something in some ways inferior, or at least kind of a, you know, this is a new, not quite a fad, but a thing for the kids these days. They don't, you know, it's not for me. I'm a writer for print, and it is a different thing, a different reading experience. You focus on it, you pay attention, the whole thing. I mean, it's really a very similar sort of debate here, I think.
I think the directors have a better argument, but granted.
But there's a secondary, we're running long in this segment, but I think it's really interesting. There's a secondary element here, which is that stuff that is in print winds up on the web anyway, which is also true of the theatrical releases, right? You know, Dune was going to be in theaters, and then it was going to be on HBO Max 3 months later anyway. So people would be able to see it on HBO Max, just not right away. They would have
and
to.
And it comes out on Blu-ray this week, and probably will be seen by far more people in the United States on small screens than it
was. You're talking about Tenet.
Tenet comes out on disc.
I was going to say,
Tenet comes out this week.
Right. And no, but right.
It's probably going to be seen by far more people on small screens.
Agreed. But the point is that the superior option is there, and it's the same thing with magazines, right?
I wrote a cover talking about releasing Dune, but it will not always be there if you destroy
the theatrical window. Theaters cannot exist. The business model does not work because people won't go.
There are very
enough people in theaters,
as you know, working for an online only publication, Sonny. Having come from the Weekly Standard, which no longer exists, the online publication, a bunch of other reasons, but the world of the internet means that print publications are struggling to stay alive as print publications, yes.
And that is exactly what is happening to theater. That is exactly what will happen to theaters. I mean, that's the same thing. It's the same exact thing.
I think that the effects are very similar, and what we're going to see is fewer print publications, not zero, and fewer movie theaters, not zero.
Yeah, you'll have theaters in New York City and Los Angeles, and the people who live in, you know, Missouri and North Dakota will have to watch the movies over their terrible broadband.
We'll have to watch things on their 90-inch OLEDs at home with their 7.1 Atmos surround systems that are better than the theater that I watched a lot of movies in as a kid.
All right, that's enough of this nonsense. What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that directors are speaking up against Warner Brothers' decision to move its entire slate to streaming?
Peter's wrongness is a controversy. The correctness of the directors is a non-controversy.
Our argument here is proof that it is a controversy. And look, I love seeing movies in the theater. I don't want that to go away completely, but I think that change is upon us and we should be thinking about what that's going to mean rather than just saying, I wish it was 2019 again and that we could hold in 2019 for forever.
It's definitely this whole thing is a controversy. Everything about this is a controversy, including Peter's terrible opinions, maybe especially Peter's terrible opinions. All right. Just as a reminder, if you enjoy the show, and who doesn't, it's a great show. Everyone loves it. Demanded it. It come back and we brought it back. Make sure you head over to atma.thebulwark.com. We will have a special bonus members only episode about the move to streaming. More of that. Peter will explain why our concept of a blockbuster will look very different in the coming years. He had a piece in the New York Times. We're going to talk about that. It's a good piece, even though he's very wrong about that and many, many other things. But go to The Bulwark Plus. We'll set you up with a membership you get to listen to.
Watching movies at home while drinking a Negroni. Good.
A poison cocktail, as we've seen. All right, and now on to the main event. Sound of Metal was supposed to be in theaters, but it got picked up by Amazon and is streaming now on Prime instead. In theory, it's the sort of movie that seems built for our streaming future, right? It's smaller in scale, it's more intimate in nature. It's the type of film that we're told will thrive in a home-first, theater-never, or theater-rarely, or theater-limited setting. In practice, seeing this at home, for most people, we'll get to your fancy setup here in a second, Peter Suderman. But for most people, it is not going to be what you would hope for. In fact, it could be kind of a disaster. At the very least, it will be deeply unfulfilling. Because here is what you miss when you watch at home: enveloping, encompassing sound. And this is a movie in which sound design matters a lot. Riz Ahmed plays a drummer for a metal band named Ruben, and after a show one day he realizes he lost much of his hearing. A doctor tells him not to play again, lest he risk losing the rest. Advice he promptly ignores. He goes deaf. His girlfriend and bedmate Lulu, played by Olivia Cooke, sets him up with a sort of halfway house for the deaf, combination rehab center and educational outpost. He has to learn how to be deaf, you see, sign language and all that, sure, but also just coming to grips with the fact that things have changed for him forever, and there's no getting around that. He has to learn to live with this, and much of the movie is about that struggle. In order to understand what Ruben is going through and his later futile efforts to return to normalcy, spoilers, there's going to be some spoilery talk in this, I'm sure, you really have to experience it. And the only way to really experience it is in true surround sound, the sort that you can either spend many hundreds or several thousands of dollars on at home to simulate, or you can spend $10 on a ticket to experience it in a theater. You need to hear properly how muffled it is when he first loses the sound, and then later how metallic it is once he get some hearing devices to help him hear again. The title here refers less to a genre of music than it does to something else entirely, as it turns out. To properly appreciate this film, you really need to get itchy with frustration at just what Ruben has lost. Peter, you have a very good sound system at home. I joke about your CRT TV and all that stuff, but you actually have a very nice home theater setup. How was your viewing and more importantly, listening experience?
The sound design in this movie is incredible, and it just draws attention to how important sound design is in movies. Not just the qualities of the sound, but the layout. And this movie just sort of puts you in the middle of Ruben's sonic world in a way that is really pretty remarkable. I have a 7-channel surround sound system in my basement that I cobbled together over the last year or two. I've always been sort of a surround sound guy. I had like a cheap 5.1 system even in my college dorm room in like 2000, because that's a thing that I really care about. But the sort of flip side of that is that because I am someone who cares a lot about audio and who sort of lives through my ears in many ways, I found this movie absolutely nerve-wracking to watch. This was painful is not the right word, but really kind of anxiety inducing, because the thing I think that I don't know if it's the thing I fear most, but a thing that I plausibly fear in my own life a whole lot is losing my hearing. And I've had small moments where like my hearing has gone out of whack. It turned out not to be anything permanent, where like everything sounded wrong for a couple of months, and it was really disorienting, and it was really kind of incredible how effectively this movie reproduced that effect, and how intelligent and thoughtful the sound design in a movie that isn't like a big budget, big production movie, right? You don't think of this as like, oh, this is a film that's really technologically savvy. And yet it's a movie about that uses the technology of film to show us not just what people hear, but how and why it's important. And it's a really, really well-made movie. I will say that it was not always easy for me to watch, but really well-made film, quite affecting. And the third act is actually something we should probably talk about just a little bit, because it's a big departure from the rest of the film in a lot of ways. And it does a really nice job of kind of showing you, first of all, the digital glitchiness of spoiler, he ends up getting a cochlear implant, and those things are controversial in the deaf community because they seem to sort of work from the premise that being deaf is a handicap, and there is a part of the deaf community that thinks no, it's not a handicap, it's just how we are, and we're going to live with it, and we think that's a perfectly good way to be. But then when he gets this implant, it doesn't reproduce sound exactly the way that ears do, right? It uses a bunch of digital technology, and so you said it sounded metallic, but I think that the way I would describe it is that it sounds glitchy. It sounds, there's all this sort of digital noise in it as the computer basically inside the microphones that are attached to his head is trying to decode the signal and then translate it into something that fakes sound inside his brain. So it's
basically
just a
cochlear implants.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth explaining what cochlear implants do. They stimulate the cochlear nerve in your head, and they bypass your ears. Yeah. So they give you the illusion of hearing through your ears when actually you're hearing sound that's being translated directly into your head. And the movie does a good job at both explaining that in a technical way and communicating what it feels
like. And I would just say, so if you are watching this movie and you do not have a surround sound setup at home, watch it with headphones, because headphones are going to give you a good pair of over-ear headphones are going to give you that sort of really intense, intimate experience that this movie was designed to give viewers, listeners. It's a very pretty movie. It's very naturalistic in the way that it's shot as well. So we shouldn't underrate the other technical aspects, but it's a very well-made movie that I found unusually difficult to watch.
Alyssa.
I had an almost reverse or inverse reaction to Peter's, which is that I found this movie sort of surprisingly comforting and touching. I do not have a profound fear of hearing loss, but it's a movie about people who are vulnerable in tenuous situations and where everyone behaves with kindness and compassion towards everyone else. Like, I actually don't think there is a single exception to that rule in the movie. We meet Ruben and Lou when they're on tour, and it's clear, I mean, Ruben is a recovering addict, Lou has some issues with self-harm, and Ruben loses his hearing, and Lou's first concern is to make sure that he's able to stay sober, even if it means sacrificing their tour. And so she behaves in this, loving, self-sacrificial way. She gets him to this rehab community that's sort of situated within a larger set of, deaf institutions, including, I think, a church and a school. And she knows that it's a risk to herself because he has also been helping keep her healthy. There's this incredibly hilarious domestic scene in the beginning of the movie where these people who you've seen performing a really hardcore metal show, this guy who has, please kill me tattooed across his chest is getting up and making his girlfriend green smoothies and an omelet and doing all of these, calisthenics and breathing exercises.
He puts on a record and it's an old timey, singer jazz type situation. I don't know what the song was, but it's totally about a lot of the metal world where those folks, you think they're they only listen to sludge metal. And in fact, they listen to a lot of jazz and classical, stuff. But they want to play sludge metal.
And so, Lou, is willing to take a risk with her own health to get Ruben the help that he needs. He's taken into this community run by Joe Paul Ratchie, who's also a recovering addict. And you never see the people in this community get impatient or angry with him, right? He is learning how to be deaf. He is not sure that he belongs there. And people are just universally really kind to him and bring out all of these nurturing, lovely qualities. And then even when he gets the cochlear implant, which really hurts Joe. Joe is sort of firm in enforcing his boundaries. He's I have to take care of everyone in this community. This is a rebuke to the values that we have here. But he is clearly, he's not cool about it. He is clearly, sad and worried for Ruben. And then in the third act of the movie, Ruben goes and tracks down Lou. She's living back with her, obviously wealthy father in Amsterdam. And it's pretty clear that they're not going to get back together as musicians or a couple. And yet everything that happens in that third act, rather than being sort of disastrous, is pretty kind. Lou's father sits him down and is I was not always sure about you, but thank you for taking such good care of my daughter. Welcome to my home. He reverses, in the first act, Ruben was the caretaker, or now someone else is, making food for him and taking care of him. And when Lou makes it clear that, she cannot get back together with him and go on the road with him, Ruben lets her go. And I just found the kindness of the movie really beautiful and revitalizing. And so, it's a movie, there are threats, there are concerns, you do worry about Ruben falling off the wagon. But it's not a menacing movie. It's a movie where if people do the right thing, things can turn out okay. And I thought it was lovely.
Yeah, there's no big blowups in this movie, which is weird for an addiction movie. And in some ways, it really stood in contrast to Hillbilly Elegy, which I know we've talked about a lot on this podcast, but is just sort of notable here because it's another movie about addiction set in the upper Midwest. I don't know exactly where that rehab house in this movie is supposed to be, but they mention Dayton, Ohio, right? They talk about being in Missouri at one point. This is an upper Midwest, a movie about addiction in the upper and recovery in the upper Midwest, and there's not a single scene like the ones you see constantly in Hillbilly Elegy where people just explode and blow up and go crazy. Instead, there's a lot of tension and there's a lot of difficulty and a lot of hard things to get through. But probably the scene of most conflict is the one where Joe tells Ruben that he has to leave. And even that, as you said, is a scene in which Joe is trying to wish him off and wish him well. He's just saying the choice you made means you can no longer stay here.
Yeah. One thing I really liked about this film is the manner in which it kind of naturally and organically portrays the uppercase D deaf community, right? Like there's a big debate, as Alyssa kind of alluded to, within the deaf community about, you know, how much, if this is a handicap or is it just something that should be lived with? Is it, et cetera, et cetera. You can read more about it elsewhere. My colleague, Jonathan B. Last, actually wrote a longish piece about one such conflict at Gallaudet University at the Weekly Standard many years ago. What the film does, I think, is very interesting. It kind of throws Ruben into this world of deaf people, and we are, like him, kind of lost. We're trying to figure out how to understand the people he is around and how to communicate with them. He's learning sign language. He doesn't understand it at first, but as he comes to learn it, the movie shifts from us being lost to putting subtitles on the screen. Now, this does two things at the same time. One, it allows us to understand as Ruben understands, but two, it creates a sort of separation. In the understanding, it creates separation because it essentially says, it's like watching a foreign film now. It is saying, you are an outsider looking into a different community that has its own rules and its own language. Its own culture. It's very well done. It's very subtle. I don't like this movie quite as much as you did, Alyssa, but there it has nice little touches throughout. And it's very different from the sort of movie it could have been, a movie like The Wrestler, right? Where you have a kind of broken down performer trying to figure out how to live in a world in which he can't perform anymore. I mean, that's the kind of subtext to all of this, is that Ruben cannot do the thing he has spent his life doing anymore.
Or at least not in the same way. I mean, you have the scenes where he's teaching drumming to the kids at the school.
Sure.
In that great little scene, he's in a classroom and he sees a kid who is, you know, maybe 9 or 10, is clearly just really antsy. And with the teacher's permission, takes him outside and the kid starts tapping on a metal slide. And you can see both him and Ruben get a sense, oh, I can experience this through vibration. It's different, but there's still something there. And it's interesting. I mean, this is also just, I think, a really lovely actorly movie. Ratchie is not someone who's had a big role before and has this just amazingly open face that matches really well with Ahmed's. I mean, one of the things I love about Ahmed is his face is just, you know, you get the sense that his characters can never conceal what they're feeling.
Ratchie is a small enough actor that he does not have a Wikipedia page at all.
Yeah. And it's really strong.
It's phenomenal. The other person who really jumped out as being excellent, I mean, Riz Ahmed's very good, but is Lorne Ridloff as Diane, who is a teacher who mostly seems to be, and it's kind of interestingly never super explicitly spelled out exactly what the roles are and how the system works and all of that, right? It's this almost sort of documentary, like kind of just following him, and we get bits and snippets of the life that he is leading as he is learning to be deaf and learning what that means and how to live that way. But she is a deaf actress. She's apparently going to be playing a deaf superhero in Inhumans.
The
Eternals,
right?
Which I always want to say Inhumans. It's a different thing. Yes, but
different.
In the Eternals.
Fake nerd boy.
Yes.
Peter Suderman here.
It's totally true. I actually have no idea. But she just generates like such a remarkable sort of like warmness and goodwill on screen in a way that's so incredibly natural. And yet, like, this is an acted movie, right? It's not a documentary. It is not just something where they sort of, where it's constructed entirely of found footage. And she is a performer, like she's an actress, right? Like, and she's just sort of making it seem so perfectly natural and organic in a way that's really rare to see on screen.
Well, and I brought that, the sort of actorly quality of the movie up because I wanted to, you know, there's this, one of the things that it does really well is give the characters sort of characteristic gestures. And there's an early scene where Ruben's just come to the community and Joe is asking him if he wants to use. And there's this really long pause and Ahmed breathes and then closes his eyes for a second, opens them again and says, today is not a good day. And, you know, you can see what it costs him to acknowledge that. And then in the final scene of the movie, he is in Amsterdam. He has left Lou in her father's house. And he's sitting in what I think is probably Dom Square. And he's listening to the world through his implants and then takes off the receivers, sort of relaxes into the silence, looks around, and you see him take that deep breath, close his eyes, and open them again. And it's the kind of thing that, because it's been built into the movie in another important moment, but without a lot of attention being called into it, you understand it again as this sort of moment of acceptance. They don't have to punctuate the end of the movie because it gives you a guide to understanding what just that gesture means. I thought little things like that just made me feel so impressed by this. And I was going into this not expecting to like it at all and ended up just loving it.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the sound or on Sound of Metal?
Thumbs up.
I don't think I liked it quite as much as Alyssa, though I do think that the interior of the van that we see is like one of the few spaces that I've ever seen that has the right amount of audio equipment. Like, it's so, to be clear, for folks who haven't seen the movie, there's like six speakers and a huge soundboard and amps and record players, and all of this is inside like a little trailer van situation that they're living in. And it's just like, oh, I looked at that and was like, yes, that is how many speakers and how much audio gear a space that size should ideally have.
Thumbs up. In part because it had the proper number of speakers, but for other reasons too. All right, that is it for today's show. If you loved it, please make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode at Bulwark Plus. And make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed yet again. See you guys next week.